Welcome, listeners, to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. Each week on Connect the Dots, we connect the dots between everything going on in our community, society, and greater environment that impacts and interacts to affect each one of us and all of us as a whole. I'm a longstanding journalist of the environment, health, food, science, policy, and the media. And each week on the show, we talk about all of the different interactive factors that are impacting our world, including, you know, our understandings and beliefs, the role of media, and a whole host of other things. In today's program, we're going to be talking. We're kind of in the gap or the space from the recent righteous furor over the Kavanaugh nomination, which affects the future of our courts and the judicial system. And now there is, strong striving in the midterm elections to see if activists and progressive citizens can have a role in turning the outcome of and the makeup of the current Congress and even possibly Senate. And that is the hope, with many people making phone calls, canvassing, contributing, getting out the vote. We certainly want to encourage all of that. Today's guest is someone coming back to the show. I'm so delighted to have her again, because we really can, through the conversation today, get a big picture look at some of the major concerns that we need to be considering in this important time, and we'll be discussing that further on the show. Our guest today, returning guest, is Lisa Graves. She was on about a month ago speaking about the Kavanaugh nomination and was out and about in the major media at that time because of her key experience and insights into that nomination, as well as the federal judicial system, which she served at one time as a deputy assistant attorney general at the U.S. Department of Justice. So there couldn't be a more knowledgeable speaker. Lisa is also co-director of Documented Investigations. She's a well-known researcher, writer, and public speaker, and has, through her co-founding of the Center for Media and Democracy, played a key role in our getting behind the scenes and really getting into the nitty-gritty and looking at a lot of the string pulling, puppet mounting, backstage influence on our government by corporate players operating in sync at a very organized, long range, and persistent level, where we as citizens are kind of coming in a bit late, or many of us are, to the understanding that we have an obligation and really a necessity to kind of engage and make this country and its policy choices and decisions our own, you know, those that really support the commons, that support people, that support the environment. And through her work with the Center for Media and Democracy, Lisa's also, an incredible expert and really initiator of all of our understanding of ALEC, which is a backstage operation that helps corporations get together and shape public policy and then kind of hand it off to be passed by the people that backstage corporate donorship has, thanks to Citizens United, allowed them to put in office as our elected officials. I think, more and more people are kind of getting hip to that and getting activated, hopefully, to see what we can do about it. So I'm delighted to have you back. Welcome back, Lisa Graves, to Connect the Dots.
Allison, thank you so much for that lovely introduction, and it's awfully nice to be invited back on your show and have the chance to reach your listeners.
Well, I have a very concerned group, of activated group of listeners, and, we want to activate everyone and get the word out there. So, I really would love to you know, a lot of people have kind of either taken a fatalistic attitude toward the corporate takeover in effect of so many different areas of our government, and other people are maybe, you know, kind of not really wanting to know how extensive that might be. And then there are others who see the problem and are, you know, organizing to find ways to intervene. So what I'd love to do with you today is kind of get an overview of, you know, where we are now. The current news cycle as we approach the midterms has been, you know, an area rife with drama, outbursts, furores over various topics. And, you know, a lot of it is, you know, has some degree of importance, but really is also functioning as a distraction from the main event, the main issues that we really need to be facing up to and looking at how successfully we're able to intervene and address them right now. So could you give your perspective? What do you think the main event right now really is, or the main events, the things that are obvious that people are concerned about, and maybe a few that are not so obvious that we need to be aware of?
Well, you know, it's a little hard to narrow down, although I appreciate your effort to try to find the key things to lift up. I have to say that I really think this issue with the murder of Jamil Khashoggi is extraordinary and horrifying. And I think that what it reveals in its sort of most brutal or even gruesome form is just the complete disrespect for the rule of law by President Trump, the willingness to defend his friends against all evidence against them, to ignore just basic norms in our society and human rights law in general, and to do so for sort of really craven, venal reasons. And I know that for some reason that has not yet managed to diminish Trump's standing in polls, even though he continues to be, you know, not have a majority of support. But it's such an astonishing and outrageous thing. You have an American, a journalist who's a journalist for an American newspaper who has American children, who was writing for one of the most significant papers in our country, the Washington Post, who was murdered in the Saudi embassy in Turkey. And you have this really quite outlandish, you know, show of a supposed investigation or a supposed inquiry by Mike Pompeo, President Trump's Secretary of State, with this smiling press conference with the Crown Prince in Saudi Arabia, and then these just totally incredible claims coming out of Saudi Arabia that Trump has credited, and yet somehow he can go to a protest or go to a stadium, an election sort of rally, and talk about the rule of law as if he supports it in any way at all. And so I think for me, not that you needed to see something so grotesque to display Trump's utter unfitness for the position that he holds, but I hope that somehow it wakes more people up that America cannot stand for this, and that our only resort at this point as a people is to come out and vote and bring not one, not two, but five or six people with us to vote to say this is not okay for America. It's not okay for America to go along with the murder of a journalist who criticized Trump. It's not okay for America to ignore human rights. It's not okay for America to just blatantly ignore the rule of law and reason. I don't know. So that's really been on my mind, I have to say, this past week or two.
It definitely has a chilling effect on journalists, a free press, and our ability to kind of help the public hold officials accountable, hold companies accountable, and sort of separate the wheat from the chaff. in terms of, you know, what's going on today in our government. I mean, you know, it's like, and you know, it's not only that the Trump administration and Trump himself have, you know, kind of tolerated this, but it's also applauding when somebody hits a journalist, treating them like your personal prey. Are you aware of, you know, historically where, you know, countries have done this kind of thing, even if we kind of go, well, I don't like this press or I don't like that press outlet, which, you know, I don't give a lot of credence to, like, say, Fox News would be one that I would mention. And then there are people also critical of, you know, what they call the liberal media or whatever, and we know that the progressive media has been under attack. But, you know, what happens to countries that denigrate, you know, what is called the Fourth Estate because it plays an interventionist role, you know, in times of duress and power grabbing and overreach? I mean, what happens?
Well, I mean, when I hear your question, what I think about is the fact that, you know, Trump has touted his admiration for some of the most repressive regimes on earth. That includes Putin, where there have been so many murders of journalists in Russia itself, as well as in the countries that Russia is seeking to dominate, in Ukraine, for example. You know, you have North Korea, where there is no free press, where people are, you know, imprisoned for having any dissenting opinion. There's no free press. You have the Philippines, where there's, you know, basically a dictatorial leader who has embraced, you know, hit squads, death squads, basically, for supposed drug dealers, but you know, there's really no limit to death squads once you unleash them. And Saudi Arabia, which is an extremely repressive regime, and I don't care how many weapons have been purchased or not purchased, or the ongoing exaggerated claims of Trump of the supposed weapons deal and what it means for any actual American in the United States in terms of blood money in exchange for abandonment of the rule of law. I just think that this path of repression of journalists, of attack of journalists, the idea that the American free press is the enemy of the people is so outlandish and horrifying and absurd. And yet you have people at his rallies who, you know, attack the journalists, who are sort of incited to be hostile toward journalists. You have Trump himself embracing the idea of physically attacking journalists. And in some ways, the image that comes to mind, aside from, you know, the obvious ones of those rallies and the way he has the press pinned on the side for people to parade by and you know, sort of with spittle attack them baselessly. But the image that comes to mind to me in some ways is the image that is at the end of Ava DuVernay's film, The 13th, the film I was in to talk about ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council. But what Ava has done in that film is take a look at these white crowds that were attacking Black citizens of America as they stood up for civil rights. And there's an image that she plays in the film of this crowd pushing and shoving this African-American man who's dressed in a suit and his hat falls off, and they're pushing him and attacking him. And she overlays that image with a very similar image of a person, not a journalist, but of another African-American being pushed out of a rally. And I think what the American people are seeing is that this old, awful, hateful, sort of, I don't want to call it a tradition, but this tendency on the part of some has been really unleashed by this president. It never went away in some ways. There's always been a deep racism among some in the United States. I think it's a solid minority, but it's pretty solid, unfortunately. And Trump through his attacks on President Obama of not being an American, those outlandish smears against him, the Fox News dog whistles throughout Obama's presidency, the right wing, the farther right wing, the Breitbart World and Daily Caller, and then beyond, really pushing this racism, has unleashed this this hostility. And along with that hostility comes an attack on institutions, the institutions that would challenge that racism. In the 60s, the institutions that were assailed were the courts, or the idea that the federal government would have any say in insisting that there be equal protection under the law. In this era, you have both this attack on civil rights, on people being who are peacefully protesting, calling them the mob, which is outlandish. That's what Trump is doing now, is trying to paint progressives and people of conscience, moderates, the array of people who come out for the marches from all walks of life, all backgrounds, to try to paint them as a mob, while he himself has unleashed mob behavior and has, called the Nazi protesters in Charlottesville good people. This sort of thing is going on because Trump is helping to orchestrate it, and he is including in that the attack on key institutions in the U.S., which includes the institution of having a free press that can report critically on him.
Yeah, he doesn't want that at all. And you know, in keeping with both his kind of disdain for democracy as well as personal narcissism, it's kind of like about him personally, l'état c'est moi, which means the state that's me, which is this over-identification of an individual with the power and seat of government in the executive branch. I mean, the whole idea of checks and balances is to protect against precisely that, either an individual or powerful forces that are vested, from taking the rule of the people and the commons as their own, and sort of shunting the people aside, calling them a mob. There's a political cartoon that's been circulating where there's a group marching peacefully but with very angry expressions down a street, and there are two young guys, off on the curb looking into the group, and the group is mostly women who are very angered in this particular cartoon, and one of the guys is going, "Mom," and the other one is going, "Nana," and it's like, the angry mob is women, in this particular cartoon. And, of course, in reality, it's not only women, who are kind of activated and disgruntled because their lives, the lives of their children, of their grandchildren, of future generations of humans, of, young beings, animals, all that kind of intersects to support, create a web of support for lives on Earth, is being undermined, and women have always been the kind of caretaker gatekeepers of that, and maybe not always so politically active, but certainly feeling it now. I thank you for those important reminders. One question I have, and I'm not sure if this is something that you can answer, and maybe it is or not, but with all the voter purges that we're seeing, or the attempts to purge votes, it seems like we're fighting on multiple fronts. People are trying to get certain candidates passed, Justice Democrats, people in close races, and to try to kind of change the majority balance of the Congress and perhaps even the Senate, now that we've kind of virtually lost the court with the nomination of Kavanaugh. But as we're, kind of voting, donating, phone banking, canvassing, and raising up the people that would make a real difference in government, we simultaneously have this attack on the very process of voting, the rights and equity of all people to vote. I mean, it feels like the myth of Sisyphus in a way, putting, you know, pushing the rock up the hill while someone's kind of pushing it down again through purging voters and closing voting places. Any thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, call to mind Michelle Alexander as the new Jim Crow, and in other ways in which this is in some ways the new Jim Crow. The idea that in America in 2018 there would be such a determined effort by one party to disenfranchise American citizens from voting is extraordinary. In some ways, it makes me realize how none of these battles is ever really won. You know, you have the civil rights movement, occurred over many decades, but which really reached its zenith in power and influence in the 1960s, culminating in the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and the Voting Rights Act of 1965, which in particular was designed to deal with the Jim Crow patterns of the South in terms of denying people the right to vote, using all sorts of methods to block people from voting, literacy tests, poll taxes, and more. Now you have, in some ways, although it's hard to say it's a more naked use of that power, but it's certainly a more macro use of that power through Republicans in Secretary of State positions in the states, which oversee in most states the voting procedures within that state. You have what's happening in Georgia with the candidate for governor, who is also currently the Secretary of State, who has purged enormous numbers of voters while he himself is facing, is running for election to a higher office and using his post as an assault on the right of Georgians to vote. It's astonishing. It's happening and was happening in Kansas with Kris Kobach and his using his post as Secretary of State to limit voters. But unfortunately, it's not the first time we've seen these Secretary of State positions being used to advance a partisan agenda, one that is disproportionately impacting people of color, for example, in Georgia. We saw that in Florida in 2000 with Katherine Harris, who was the Secretary of State, who was also the Bush, George W. Bush campaign chair, who purged voter rolls there in ways that certainly had an impact on that election that was, in my view, stolen by the U.S. Supreme Court by a five to four partisan majority of that court stopping a recount. But she helped she helped skew the vote before that recount even started by her purging of voters. Then she was rewarded by Republicans in that state with a short tenure in the U.S. Congress. So these positions are all really important. It's important to have fair people serving as Secretary of State versus partisan hacks. And it's really unbelievable that someone would be able to hold that post while running for another office, and there wouldn't be some sort of rule that they automatically have to recuse themselves.
Exactly.
So anyway, I just think it's astonishing that we have this wave, sort of an unapologetic wave, to deny people the right to vote. You had the decision in North Dakota, which is so outrageous. The idea that people who live on reservations, the American Native Americans who live there, who have post office boxes, that their IDs, the forms of IDs they've been using for years to vote, don't count, that they've got to somehow provide some additional proof that they are who they say they are beyond the identification that they have in the post office box that they use in these rural areas. There's very limited time for thousands and thousands of those Native American voters to get the right ID in North Dakota at a time when that race there for the United States Senate is so close. You literally have the destruction of the right to vote happening in several states in America. You have a president who, of course, would never speak against that. In fact, favors these measures, anything to win. And yet America, you know, is supposed to be a country that that is a model for democratic processes. Of course, we're not, unfortunately. But now we're at a almost, hopefully it's a zenith. Hopefully it will be repelled. But the level of voter denial happening in this country right now is truly appalling.
I mean, do you, the thing that's so worrying about this is if people were allowed to vote, if all of this activity and ferment were happening, we would be gaining, you know, a number of states and possibly even majorities. I mean, how, my concern is we could see this negatively impacting that. I mean, it can't be good for it. And yet at the same time, we don't want to throw our hands up in the air and say, oh, my God, I give up. They have it all and there's nothing I can do. I think there are, I think I see people going in both directions on that. Your view?
Well, I think you're right. I mean, the reality is that everyone needs to check to make sure that they're registered. You need to call your local office, make sure that you're properly registered. There's time to make sure that's happening. Obviously, early voting is happening in some states, and there have been efforts to try to limit that as well. But, you know, it really boils down to, I think in some ways, maybe it's the what we saw in Ohio, where people were so outraged by the voter restrictions put in place in that state that people came out to vote, you know, and stood in line for hours to make sure that they had a right to vote. The reaction to this, you know, really can't be to give up and let them win. The reaction has to be to encourage people to stand up and get so many people there that their cheating can't prevail. You know, as hard as it is to take the day off to vote, to make sure there's no way you're going to allow these guys, these men and women of the right wing to deny you the right to vote. You know, making sure that you are asking your friends and family members to come out and vote because it matters. I know one of the objectives of these measures is not just to deny the people, you know, some people the right to vote, but to basically suppress the vote through making people think it doesn't matter, it won't count, or it will be a hassle. That lets them win. And so my philosophy on these things, as all things, is, you know, if you don't try, you definitely lose. If you do try, you may win, and you may win resoundingly. And so if you give up, if you, you know, don't take every effort that you can reasonably take to try to protect and advance our democracy, the bad guys will win. We just can't afford to let them win. There are too many things at stake. You know, climate change is at stake. We have a very limited window to try to move forward in redressing the climate change that's underway. You know, that's one thing. We have, you know, the actual global security of our world with a guy in power who doesn't respect the devastating effect of nuclear weapons and, you know, thinks because his uncle went to MIT that somehow he's got some sort of extra expertise in appreciating their value. You know, so, you know, international issues are at stake. The rule of law is at stake in terms of whether we're going to have an independent or a special counsel be able to continue his investigation, the most serious investigation into the conduct of a president, I think, in the history of the United States, in terms of whether there's evidence of Trump and his Trump's agents conspiring with a foreign power to distort our very elections. And so nothing could be – this is a time in our country where – so much is at stake. It can seem overwhelming, but just one day at a time, one foot in front of the other, just making sure that we're voting, that we're talking to people, asking them to vote, making sure people are registered, making sure people get out and have their votes cast, and then insisting that those votes be counted and counted accurately.
Yeah, that's all incredibly important. You know, all of this, it occurs to me, is, I mean, I've felt this for a while, is we're all functioning in the aftermath of Citizens United. You know, we have people in office at all levels who are beholden to background donors and corporate interests, and they're kind of posturing as if they're representing us, and in some cases they're not even posturing, they don't even bother and all of that. Since the passage of Citizens United, was there ever a moment or an opportunity when we could have reversed it? What would it take to reverse it going forward? Is it even possible, given the current makeup of the Supreme Court?
Well, that's a great question, and I actually I'm one of the few people who came out immediately upon the issuance of that decision in January of 2010, calling for it to be reversed, and in fact calling for a constitutional amendment to reverse it. Because I knew it would be devastating to our democracy and that we have to pursue all lawful means to overturn it. And I think that having a movement of people calling for its reversal is essential. A constitutional amendment is a very difficult process to secure, but it is a matter of principle, a matter of the values of our country to pursue it. And I think that through pursuing it, that provides opportunities for organizing, for people to organize within their communities and within their state to press an array of changes that are necessary to address a lot of the outcomes of that decision. There was a moment in the couple years after Citizens United where there was a chance for there to be a provision to require disclosure. Even the weak T of disclosure, of saying you have to disclose who your donors are to these outside groups that are now outspending the candidates themselves and outspending the parties. And that was blocked by McConnell. It was blocked by the Republicans. It was blocked by that party to even have disclosure of this inherently corrupting process where these outside groups are raising huge sums that exceed the limits on donations to an individual candidate or to an individual party, or to a PAC, a political action committee, and instead using that money, raising that money in unlimited amounts, millions and millions of dollars, and then spending that money to distort our elections, the Republicans blocked even having any disclosure of it, let alone blocking that activity itself. And so that was an opportunity that was missed, and there was not sufficient punishment of those members who blocked even the baseline of disclosure. Meanwhile, you have the Koch brothers and the Koch brothers groups attacking even the idea of disclosure. They have sought to, transform the idea of free speech into money, that money is speech, and then to import into that doctrine free speech law that says that you shouldn't pass any laws that chill free speech. So their argument in essence is that if there's disclosure, people will be chilled from spending this unlimited money to these dark money groups to influence our elections. And so even disclosure must be barred, even disclosure to state authorities, as in California. There was litigation that the Koch brothers pursued these past couple of years in California to block the state from even having access to the identities of donors, let alone the public. So this is an assault on our basic functioning of our democracy, and it's an assault that's spearheaded by the Koch brothers, by Charles Koch in particular, one of the richest men in the entire world, and the politicians who are beholden to him, like Mitch McConnell, who leads the Senate right now and has presided over the most dysfunctional and disrespectful period of the Senate in modern history in terms of trying to totally take over the United States Supreme Court. But there are other things that can happen. It's possible for the number of judges on the Supreme Court to be expanded. And I would say that the number 9 is not set by the U.S. Constitution. The U.S. Constitution merely provides for there to be a United States Supreme Court. It doesn't set the number. The number of justices has been different over time. 9 is the most recent tradition of the past several decades, but it's not always the case. And it's not a magic number. And quite frankly, you have a Supreme Court with some changes that happened in the Reagan administration that basically is only hearing the cases that a majority chooses to hear. So they're handpicking the cases in which they want to change our rights. And they're doing so by ignoring thousands and thousands of cases that are that seek review by the Supreme Court through this petition for certiorari. So thousands of cases every year seek a file what's known as a cert petition for the Supreme Court to hear a case, and thousands of cases are ignored by this court because it chooses only 80 to 90 cases per year, and it chooses those cases because those are the cases that the Roberts majority, that the majority chosen by George W. Bush and George Herbert Walker Bush in the case of Thomas and now Trump, the cases that that Republican majority on that court wants to change our rights in. So they have untrammeled power to change our rights through choosing those cases. And that number 9 of 9 justices of the Supreme Court is not a magic number, and it's not set in stone. And I think we should at some point start having a conversation about what the size of the Supreme Court should be.
You know, it's so stunning, as I hear you saying this, that on the one hand, we have this amazing attack, you know, an attack on journalism, incitements to murder journalists, constant criticism of journalism, refusal to give information, to disclose, to be transparent, to answer questions at press conferences, to ridicule members of the press at press conferences, you know, as if the game of favor is an individual's right to bestow. All of this is a very deep attack on free speech and has a chilling effect on everyone's free speech, both the ability of the press to report as well as an individual's sense that they can participate, speak freely, et cetera. And in your you know, analysis, which I believe to be completely, completely accurate of, like, you know, what the kinds of cases the court is choosing and weighing in on, instead we have a transfer of the right to free speech to corporations, as if their speech alone, you know, is to be protected, while the human and, by extension, the press right to free speech is to be denied. What does that portend?
Yeah, I mean, that actually is one of the most stunning things that has happened in the last 8 years, is that while citizens, for instance, in Wisconsin, where I led the Center for Media Democracy, citizens were being arrested for holding up a piece of paper in the gallery of the Capitol, a piece of paper that had the First Amendment written on it. That got people arrested. People in Wisconsin were arrested for singing in the Capitol. People were arrested for tapping their toe in the Capitol. Wall Street protesters during Occupy Wall Street were arrested, you know, for, you know, occupying, for speaking out at about the bailout of the banks and the fact that the bailout, you know, basically rewarded those banks and did not, and the Republicans were blocking bailouts to ordinary citizens who were facing unprecedented rates of foreclosure of their home. Citizens across the country have been restricted in basic rights of assembly. There's an effort to try to limit the ability of people to protest pipelines by calling it, you know, a critical infrastructure, and therefore trying to make it into felonies to protest the expansion of these petroleum companies in our country as they try to, you know, push pipelines, you know, like XL pipeline, which was being pushed through Nebraska and more. And so increasingly, protest and dissent is being criminalized at a, you know, at an increasing rate. One of those bills is an ALEC bill, by the way. We've had journalists who have been charged with crimes for reporting on those rallies, like Amy Goodman from Democracy Now! And others. And you also have just this basic attack on the idea of lawful, peaceful protest of civil disobedience, as with the way that Trump has attacked the women and men who came to the Capitol to express their upset over Kavanaugh's nomination. Kavanaugh, who was accused of rape, you know, of sexual assault, a person who there was credible eyewitness testimony had assaulted a person and other evidence of his lying under oath, that people would not have the right to peaceably assemble and dissent under our First Amendment, that that can be criminalized time and time and time again in this era. And yet corporations spending unlimited money in our elections, as well as CEOs spending unlimited money in our elections through these dark money vehicles, they're not subject to any criminal penalty. They're not subject to regulation, in essence, or very little regulation at all besides coordinating. And in some states, like Wisconsin, the Republicans changed the rules to allow coordination. In Wisconsin, Governor Scott Walker was literally raising money for the dark money groups, making phone calls. The evidence came out in The Guardian of him making phone calls asking for million-dollar checks from CEOs across the country to fund the dark money groups that then spent money backing him up and backing up the senators, Republican senators in the state, over his attack on labor. He knew exactly who those donors were. He called them. The only people who didn't know who those donors were American citizens of Wisconsin. And so you have this completely upside down scenario, as you point out, in which corporate rights are given dominance, in which the rights of huge money, of the wealthiest interest in our country that are trying to distort our elections, are given a privileged secret space to influence our democracy, while ordinary people seeking to exercise their fundamental freedom of conscience under our First Amendment are under attack, and while journalists who are acting in pursuit of the fundamental right of freedom of the press that is guaranteed by our First Amendment are being attacked by the president himself and his mob-like followers.
Yeah, it's really it is. It's a quite a stunning reversal, you know. And yet, I know. I mean, obviously, I'm a journalist, so you know where my allegiance stands and views on this would be immediately, you know, they're exactly like yours. I sometimes talk to other people and, you know, recount some of this, and they say stuff like, I have nothing to hide. No one is going to be interested in me. So, you know, when there is this kind of sense of suppression and, you know, it's dangerous to be involved. I remember I was consulting a dentist at one time who had some views about holism and some other things in health that were somewhat unconventional. But he felt afraid to sign a petition, you know. So I think the dilemma that we have is that the more and more people shut down in fear as the overreach and the domination becomes more and more prominent and dominant, and, you know, we can see it all kind of coming down, the less, you know, the chances that we can redress the thing diminish, and then it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. And, you know, the concern is that one could quite readily if this were to continue to devolve, really find options limited and having to accede to accept, you know, and try to go along or trundle along, living in an authoritarian state of some kind. What do you see in our last, you know, 15 minutes on the show as the upside possibility and the downside concern of the outcomes at the coming midterms?
Well, let me just say before I address that, Allison, I mean, I take tremendous solace and encouragement from the bravery and the courage of the freedom riders and the civil rights activists in the 1960s. They literally were facing death at the hands of their fellow citizens. And they stood up because it was a moral necessity that they stand up. It's a moral imperative to stand up. Now, it's certainly the case that in this day and age with, you know, the electronic trail that trails you for jobs and things, that some future employer, you know, could use against you your expression of a point of view. But quite frankly, you know, I think you can't want to work for someone who would use your, you know, your views against you, right? I mean, sometimes it's a necessity. And so people have to make their own decision about what level of engagement they're willing to engage in. Some people are willing to put their bodies on the line peacefully to act in civil disobedience and stand up. Some people, that's not their comfort zone. They prefer to donate money to support those groups. Some people want to support litigation to sue for the voter repression. Some people want to sign the petitions and try to add their voice that way. There are so many different ways that people can take action that are safe, and that help move the ball forward. And so, and at the same time, I think it's important to really have respect and respect and to honor those people who are willing and able to go and speak out in person to say, this is unjust, this is immoral, this cannot stand. But in terms of what lies ahead, I know everyone hears this from time to time, the most significant election in our lifetime. I think 2016 may have been the most significant election in our lifetime, but this is the second most, perhaps, because in my personal view, we have to have a check on Trump. We have to have some guardrail. It's essential, in my view, that the House have the power to conduct hearings and subpoena power. We know that the Republicans will not act as any reasonable check at all on this president. They've been cowed by the polling numbers of his sort of rabid supporters beyond all reason. They are unwilling, even members who are retiring like Flake and Corker, are unwilling to really stand up for real in how they vote. And so we're never going to be able to put a check on him, on Trump, without a Democratic check on him, without having at least one House in Congress, if not both. So it's really important. But beyond that, we, despite the effort of Trump to take over the courts and his success in ramming Brett Kavanaugh through, the fact is that there still are some fair judges out there. There still are opportunities to litigate and to try to protect our basic human rights and our statutory rights through litigation. That's an important tool to proceed with. Looking ahead toward 2020, that's essential work to try to move the ball forward and repudiate Trump and move in favor of a vision of America that is much more inclusive, that has a baseline of civility and respect, that wants to have a great public schools and great public parks and an economy that is thriving and filled with opportunity and not this racist bias that is dominant under Trump. And so I think we have a lot of work ahead of us in the next couple of weeks and a lot of work ahead of us in the next couple of years to put the country back on the right track. That's my hope.
And you see the potential with so many people really clearly seeing the problem now for that to happen. I mean, I think the whole thing that happened in 2016, where people were presented with two candidates that they did not feel favorably toward, and then one group vested their hopes in this renegade position, that Trump has occupied, that was a kind of disaster. But it's hard to imagine currently that anyone who is, has any stake in the future would be sitting on their hands at this moment in time. So especially as it isn't a presidential election, it's a great opportunity in every community to, at a local to regional to, state level to get involved. And I do see a lot of people doing that, I have to say. That is the kind of hopeful scenario. And I mean, it would be a wonderful vision to recover some of this, to rebuild our society. The thing is, this is not what the majority of people actually want.
And in fact, that's why they're trying so desperately to suppress the vote, because what most Americans want is fully funded Social Security that really provides people with the income necessary to not be impoverished after they've finished working in the U.S. workforce and they've retired. People want access to healthcare, real access to healthcare that doesn't bankrupt them when they're sick or when their kid is sick or when their parent is ill. They want to have public schools that are affordable, whether it's public university that doesn't make you an indentured servant for decades ahead to corporations, or whether it's public schools that are thriving and function well to make sure kids have opportunities to pursue their talents and their dreams. People want an environment that has clean water and clean air and where we are having a 21st century economy that builds on new technology like solar energy and more to, you know, help us, you know, have cleaner a cleaner environment and address climate change. Issue after issue after issue, equality is an issue where most Americans under a certain age have a strong commitment to equality, including equality on gender issues and racial issues. But there is a sort of a dinosaur group that does not. And they are clinging to their power with everything they've got. But the majority of America, the rising majority of America, a more diverse America, a more committed to equal opportunity America, an America more committed to protecting our environment, is rising. And my hope is that ultimately that majority will take power, will be democratically elected, and will bring brand new great ideas for how to have a truly better society, not making America great again in some sort of throwback to the past, but making America fulfill its vision for the 21st century through these great new ideas. And so many young people and women, white women, women of color, and others who have decided to run and are going to transform our society for the better.
Mm-hmm. It is. It's really interesting how, you know, all of it comes out at the same time. I was, you know, reading a presentation that had been given at Bioneers by Dr. Rupa Marya, who's a physician who had also served at Standing Rock. And you know, she really does this analysis of how, you know, the corporate structures that have engineered this takeover and have systemically disenfranchised, you know, people beginning with the Native American populations of this land, you know, and then on to currently attacking immigrants and creating all of this duress and trauma for the sake of their own financial benefit, an unlimited level of benefit that no individual really needs. And, you know, it becomes purely symbolic unless you, you know, anyone needs a gold-plated toilet or whatever. You know, and it's really a form of illness. And I think we can, you know, in her analysis, and coming from a health background myself, reporting on health for, you know, 30 years or more, I see it the same way. It's a societal illness, and now we can see it writ large with, you know, uncaring, greedy people at the top, someone with a mental health problem at the top. And, you know, we have to recover this society, take it back, help it recover the, you know, the better programs and visions that we were moving toward, and not be, you know, kind of put off or frightened by some of the illness and the illness and ailments in our neighbors, in our community, you know, that is manifesting in this harsh and kind of way. This is not health. And so instead of an individual vision of health, which is, you know, where I began in health reporting and this network also, we have to look for a collective and civic vision of health. You know, what is a healthy society? How do we help recover that? How do we make laws and regulations and policies that are protecting health and the environment rather than actually driving us toward extinction, you know, while we just kind of live in the moment? So, you know, yeah, this moment was good, but, you know, we have to think a little more strategically. What is the next 20 years of moments leading to climate chaos going to be like, you know, if we don't think ahead? The, you know, the corporate side has been supremely well organized. I mean, they've been organizing, planning, and plotting, and step by step putting this whole thing in, while we've been giving our attention to our presence in the individual moment. Beautiful though that is, centering as that can be, if we don't really look at the big picture, you know, we have to look at the big picture to create the vision and the sense of unity around creating it. You know, and even with other people in other places that are not, you know, just the ones right there where we are, that are just like us, that are familiar to us. You know, we have to do it with everyone. We have to, you know, this is the promise of America, and this is the need of the world. So, I, you know, if we don't bring it off, it's going to be deep doo-doo, but we won't go there right now.
Yeah, that's gallows humor right there. I have to say that was a nervous laughter on my part. You know, I do think that there's a lot of suffering among the American people, and I have to believe at some level that some subset of the Trump supporters are really suffering enormously. Unfortunately, they're so easily manipulated by Trump and by the lies told by Fox News so consistently, and Tucker Carlson's Daily Caller and these outlets that just, you know, lie to them to stoke their fears. There's tremendous fear. And I know that it's been hard to have conversations among some people and within your own family, because this idea of embracing Trump is so repugnant to so many because of the racism and the sexism and misogyny and more. But at the same time, we have to, you know, have a majority of people, whether they're progressives or moderates, just people who didn't vote last time, who realize they've got a stake in this country and they need to vote to protect that stake, that vision for a better future, one that is not led by this fearmonger, this person who loves totalitarian leaders and who disrespects basic fundamental American institutions, including the rule of law.
Yes, and that's a big one. And the thing is that, you know, if you think that the rule of law isn't something you need, or it doesn't apply to you, and you think it's just for some other group that you don't like, or, you know, that you're fearful of for whatever reason, if you think it's just for them, you know, you could find yourself sadly mistaken, because the whole principle of the rule of law, and of course saying this in front of you is kind of amusing, Lisa, because of your deep background in the law, but the purpose of the rule of law is to protect everyone. So we want to look at all these laws as being neutral, you know, and protective. If it happened not just to him over there, or, you know, whom I don't like, or whom I think, you know, they're strange or different and I can't buy into who they are for whatever reason. And we have to turn that around in our minds and say, what if that law affected me, affected the people I care about, affected my folks? Because that's the whole purpose of the law. It should be affecting, it does affect everyone, you know.
And the law isn't divided.
Yeah.
That's the challenge, because there are sometimes unjust laws. You can see the edicts being issued by this administration on immigration that turn on its head basic approaches to asylum that are core to fundamental human rights that the United States has protected over many years. And so what our hope is that the law is just, and that the rule of law means that we will have just laws. And if we don't have just laws, like the Citizens United is not a just law, it has to be overturned, it has to be repudiated. People have to organize to make the law more just.
And that's part of what we're voting for, too, in this next election. Well, we're down to the end of our show. Once again, talking with Lisa Graves, it's just been an amazing and terrific conversation. I so appreciate your work and everything you're doing. How would you like our listeners to stay in touch with your work and what you're doing? You know, what is the best way for them to do that ongoing, something they could support?
Oh, sure. That's great, Allison. Well, they can follow me on Twitter. I'm at the Lisa Graves, and our website is documentedinvestigations.org. That's documentedinvestigations.org. And people can contact me if they have tips about investigative stories. In the meantime, I hope people, you know, really make sure that they are registered to vote and they get six people they know to vote.
Terrific. And then, you know, we'll have you back again sometime afterward to see where we are.
Excellent.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Allison. Thank you so much for having me on. Thank you.
Oh, you're very welcome. It's been my pleasure. And thank you, listeners, for being with us for another edition of Connect the Dots. We'll be back next Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm Allison Rose Levy. Heads up, keep marching forward.
Well, Ooh.